You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 436 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And I don't really know why I came in so hot there. We're in different locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
I'm in Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks, who played a very fun game on Monday Night Football against the Detroit Lions today. 36, though. I want to say, can you think of any notable 36s?
I will have to open the list. Did Lawyer Malloy wear 36 for the Seahawks?
I don't think so. I thought he was 30, maybe.
Where is the file?
This is my favorite part of podcasting.
Oh, yeah. Waiting for someone to open a file?
Waiting for someone to open a file.
Oh. 36 here. Yes, Lawyer Malloy did wear 36 for the Seahawks. Azeem Victor?
Oh.
For the Huskies?
Okay.
I don't know for sure if Azeem Victor is notable enough to get his name in there, but shouts to Azeem Victor.
It's notable enough for me.
I'm very impressed. The Lawyer Malloy wore 36 for the Patriots as well. Is this what I'm seeing? Was
Azeem
number
Victor
9
U-Dub is more notable than Lawyer Malloy's Seahawks tenure.
Yeah, he did wear 36 for the Patriots. I have completely erased that from my memory that is the case. So, there you go. Well, as you noted, the Seahawks, this is semi-emergency pod. The Seahawks played on Monday Night Football earlier Monday, as one does, and played the Detroit Lions and fell from the ranks of the unbeaten. It was a very impressive performance, generally speaking, for the offense, and a bit of a cruel awakening for the defense, particularly playing shorthanded without Leonard Williams and Byron Murphy III on the defensive line, or Byron Murphy II on the defensive line, and then losing Julian Love during the course of this game at safety. The combination of those and Ben Johnson scheming up some stuff, the Seahawks defense got cooked in a way that it has not at any point during the first three games of the Mike McDonald era.
I actually yelled at one point when there was an open receiver in the secondary, "It's Pete Carroll calling this game defensively."
Oh, no. I mean, actually, no, because the thing about it is, aside from like that first Lions drive that I needed to go outside because I had been painting, staining my deck prior to this game, and had finished shortly after the game had started, I was very eager to go back out there and clean up. And then there was a 12-play, 93-yard drive. Like, these were not a lot of long drives, necessarily. It was a 1-play, 70-yard drive, a 5-play, 70-yard drive.
No,
so the offense was getting the ball back.
Pete was definitely like, that's what we don't give up. We do not give up explosives. We keep everything in front of us. It was actually an anti-Pete Carroll game. I'm sure Mike McDonald is losing his mind.
Yes, I can agree.
Watching this defense play.
Time of possession for the record in this one. Seahawks, 34 minutes time of possession to 26 minutes.
That's what I'm saying. Very anti-Pete Carroll game.
Because it's, you know, I feel like the first few games of the season, they felt to a large degree like a continuation of the Pete Carroll era in some ways. I mean, like, obviously the defense was performing at a way higher level than it ever did. But like every once in a while, the Pete Carroll defenses would have these late era Pete Carroll defenses would have these amazing games. And that's what they felt like. But this felt very different where the whole Pete Carroll slash, as we saw the other day, why am I blanking on the name of the Dan Quinn rule of, you know, if you add your completions and your rushes in a game, the Seahawks had 57 completions and rushes today. That's a guaranteed victory under that math, but not so fast, my friends.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stats you can look at that look like guaranteed victories. But when you give up,
I mean, 56 pass attempts usually is not a guaranteed victory.
I guess that's true. But also when you're giving up 7.8 yards per play to the Lions, they didn't have that many plays because sometimes it happened very quickly and sometimes there was a short field or whatever. But
right.
There are a lot of things that you can look at. To me, overall, though, knowing what we know about this, and I think when we preview this game, I think the extent of the injuries wasn't as clear. And when I saw fully the defensive linemen who were out of the game, when we previewed it, I don't think I'd realized, again, fully that it was Boye Mafe, Leonard Williams, Byron Murphy.
The Boye Mafe thing came up during practice this week, didn't it? I don't think that was
on
our radar. Like, we knew that Williams and Murphy were questionable.
They were hurt in the previous game. But I kind of felt like they were going to work their way back and play. And then you add in the Julian Love injury. Even going into it, though, I was kind of like, you know what? The defense might. It was going to be a test of Mike McDonald's scheme versus skill. And there is still a difference. Skill still matters defensively. And some of the stuff that he was trying to do just straight didn't work because it required probably a little bit more pressure on the quarterback. And the players who are there just aren't as good as some of the players who are out. And that is, if you look at it, I mean, I think the secondary is quite good, but that's maybe four of your best defensive players in the entire team. And the season that Boye Mafe has had so far this season, and, you know, just how consistent Leonard Williams is, how Byron Murphy's been awesome so far. Like, they were missing some massive pieces going in. We already knew that the linebackers were a weakness. And then also having a linebacker not play as well. Like, all of a sudden, they were without six starters out of 11 on the defense. Is that right?
I don't know. I guess, yes, by the time Julius, six key defensive players. Murphy is not a starter.
Okay, fair enough. But yes, out of their basically, like, first unit high-level subs, there was six players who are gone. It's just too many players, especially playing against a team like the Lions. I left this game. It was almost the exact opposite of how I felt on Friday night. We had these bookend of this weekend. I left this game thinking to myself, it's also the difference between college and the NFL. These are probably the two best teams in the NFC. We'll see about the Vikings.
Yeah.
But
and I'm not ready to write off the San Francisco 49ers.
I'm not writing off the Niners.
Like, one of the other things that happened this weekend is the three teams that the Seahawks beat to get to 3-0. The Dolphins, I guess they scored some points late against the Tennessee Titans. They were not scoring a lot of points for a lot of that game. With Snoop Huntley now at quarterback, so it was a different quarterback than the Seahawks faced. The Patriots got pretty summarily shellacked by the 49ers in San Francisco, in Santa Clara, technically. And then, I mean, granted, the weather conditions were awful, but the Broncos offense had negative passing, not passing yards, like negative completion yards for the entire first half.
All of that still being true, I still think this about the team. Because the stats see all those things also. Like, they're going to regress in DVOA, but you're going to look at this and they're going to be a top 10 team in DVOA at the end of it. They probably will be a top 5 team in DVOA at the end of this.
In defensive DVOA?
No, absolutely not in defensive
DVOA.
Yeah,
that's the issue. It's the ongoing week to week. Like, we talked about this after week one. After week one. Like, will the Seahawks be better this season on offense or defense in DVOA? And man, it is 4 weeks, but what a roller coaster that particular question has already been.
It's been a fun one, but the thing is, I know that you can't exactly do this. They were beaten up on defense, you know, health-wise. Like, overall, I think Ben Johnson out-schemed the Seahawks in this game. He did a phenomenal job. Like, Devin Witherspoon had one great play where he got off the block and made a tackle. But beyond that, Ben Johnson did a better job in this game than Mike McDonald did. If you were to tell me that the Seahawks went out and hired a hotshot offensive coordinator to be their head coach after this game, you'd be like, yeah, but we've got to figure out this defense. And it's funny that that's the case. I don't want to just, like, give the Seahawks a pass defensively because they got cooked by the Lions.
Yeah, because I think the other thing that happened, even setting aside the scheme element, like, when guys were in positions, they were not tackling. And Devin Witherspoon's missed tackle on the long touchdown completion was a particularly egregious example of, like, going for the highlight play instead of just making the simple tackle. But there were other situations where guys just got ran over. And that was what was so exciting in week one. And we saw a lot of terrific tackling in week three as well. And on the road, for some reason, that has not traveled, even in week two when they were a much healthier unit.
I'm definitely curious to see it going forward. I don't know if we're going to experience that necessarily against the Giants.
Right.
But I'm still so, I mean, we'll see what happens. As long as the Seahawks win the Giants game, I am still so excited for that Niners game, especially if the defense looks a little bit healthier, because
which
to
it
see
should.
Mike McDonald against that defense, I still think is going to be exciting. But to me, the other piece is Geno Smith is one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. We've gone from Geno Smith is a good quarterback. You know, it was like Geno Smith's like a Pro Bowl quarterback. All of a sudden, Geno Smith is like, I his QBR ended up not looking that good today, which is a little shocking to me because I thought Geno played a phenomenal game overall. I mean, even drawing some of the penalties that he drew, like Geno played, there was maybe even the interception at the end. It was just a great defensive play. The only play where I was like, whoa, Geno just missed it was the almost pick that
the Anzalone drop.
Yeah, the Anzalone dropped in the end zone. But overall, Geno was putting the ball exactly where it needed to go. Sometimes the receivers didn't make plays. There was a catch that DK probably should have made on the sideline on third down. Or maybe that's even a fourth down.
That was a pretty tough catch. I'm not going to blame. But Geno put the ball where it needed to be without question.
Not blame necessarily, but Geno is, and with Ken Walker, there is, it's obviously boom or bust, but Ken Walker is a different kind of running back than Zach Charbonnet is. And having him back there definitely was helpful. I thought Ryan Grubb schemed up a mostly great game. There were not situations where I was like, wow, why the fuck did he call that play in that situation? Like Ryan Grubb is an excellent offensive coordinator at the NFL level. Even the play, I mean, they got there are two plays that if you look at this, if they're slightly different, we're probably talking about a different game. DK fumbles the ball, which it's not just the Seahawks losing the ball. They return it for 50 yards or whatever. So that is a massive swing in the game that happened. And then the pick play that they called on Tyler Lockett. And if those two things don't happen, also, I think the Seahawks ended up not scoring this. It might have been too little too late. It was like a pretty obvious pass interference on the play that the Lions were offsides on that they didn't call in the end zone. So there were a few things that happened along the way that mostly penalties wise, I don't know. They were kind of mauling us out there. But
I mean, the Lions outplayed the Seahawks on a down to down basis. Like they deserve to win this game.
Their offense outplayed the Seahawks offense had to work a little bit harder than the Lions.
I mean, they averaged 7.8 yards per play.
Exactly. But I'm just saying there were a couple plays. I think it could have been closer. And like the Seahawks would have stolen this game because of how good their offense played.
Yes. I didn't drop this stat in the chat, but like, or I didn't drop this stat in last week's podcast. I mentioned it on the Discord. The Seahawks like yards per play through the first 3 weeks of the season, it was like the third fewest since the 70s. And they went for that to allow in 7.8 yards per play.
Their defensive yards per play given up.
Correct.
I mean, it is a combination of the defense actually is good. This game be damned. The defense is good. And they played pretty horrendous quarterbacks.
Right.
So, I don't think that this defense is going to get cooked in the way they did to get it today. I mean, I would be surprised if it happened again this season that they play, especially if they get healthy.
I wouldn't be shocked.
We're talking 8 yards per play. I would be shocked.
I mean, it's a lot. It's not that big.
There aren't that many teams in the league who can. I mean, Jared Goff didn't throw an incompletion.
It's true. It is.
There just aren't that many teams in the league who even have the offensive players to do that.
That's fair.
Seahawks.
But guess what? Like they came into coming into this week, they had the hardest remaining schedule in the NFL. So they're going to play a few of those teams, including
the Seahawks. Do?
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised by that.
Are you? They played three extraordinarily easy games to start this season.
But I mean, no, it's partially just because I look at the rest of the schedule and it doesn't look that hard overall. I mean, there are obviously hard games littered throughout it, but like a couple, the Cardinals and the Rams look, and you said this was coming into this week, so maybe they'll change things, but
I think Barnwell wrote about that in his look at the 3-0 teams. But I mean, by the way, we have to go all the way back to last December when they allowed 9.9 yards per play against the Niners in that game in San Francisco.
Oh, I mean, and that's why I'm excited about seeing Mike McDonald against that defense. Like Kyle Shanahan had Pete Carroll figured out by the end. The defense probably wasn't good overall, but Kyle Shanahan had them figured out. The other thing was, I mean, you saw the stat. They had the most first downs of any game in the last 10 years.
38, yeah.
And the most first downs, I think, of any losing team ever. Is that right?
Let me check that out. We've already got a look at a Seattle football record from StatHead. So we'll see if we can find from this weekend. So we'll see if we can find another here.
So
But keep talking.
again, the way that the offense played and just the magnitude of this game, it really felt like the Lions were pulling out all the stops. Like the, when they, this is a Lions thing, but hitting the Jared Goff on the Philly special. Like, I'm just like, all right, we're freaking cooked here.
I mean, the Seahawks pulled out some stops too.
And that was the other thing. So the other piece that made me feel really encouraged by this, the only fourth down where I was like, I don't know about that one. The decision making that Mike McDonald has had and the power that he's probably given to Ryan Grubb in these situations, the amount that they passed the ball in the first half, and he didn't, he was like, yeah, we have to get the running game going a little bit in the second half. He wasn't like, we need to reestablish the run. Like, I don't think anybody at the end of this game is going back and saying we passed the ball too much. This is what we wanted from a football team. They go for plays pretty aggressively. When they went for the 2-point conversion, I was like, we're doing this? The Seahawks are doing this? That is not a thing Pete Carroll does. That is not a thing. It's honestly a thing that mostly only the coach on the other side has done consistently. The fourth downs that they went for, the one on their side of the field where they just snuck it with Geno easily to Pete Carroll, you know what that play is.
Yep.
So that the play, I was watching the Patriots, I was watching Red Zone yesterday, and there was a play that ended up didn't counting because of a hold or something where the Patriots had it and they threw the lateral and picked up a first down. And I was just like, oh my God, that is such a good play. Because NFL teams, they're taught to swarm.
I
They're taught
mean,
to swarm
you
around the
saw
ball.
the Lions did this last week in Arizona.
Did they, see, I didn't see like almost anything. Again, this sucks going to games. I feel like I'm the only person on earth. But
I
every
mean, I
time
don't
people
think I
have
was
season tickets,
sitting down
whenever I tell
actively
people I have
watching
season
Red
tickets, they're
Zone.
like, oh, that's amazing. And I always want to be like, it's actually the worst thing of all time.
You know, no one is forcing you to go to the
But still, it's
games.
like a thing that you feel like you have to do. But also, I needed some red zone in my life. Meanwhile, I was coaching children's football on a lot of Sunday. But so I saw the Patriots run that, and I was like, oh my God, that's such a good play. And then the Seahawks hit it right after that. Going for it with a little bit of time left in the first half, the fourth downs that they went for, the 2-point conversion. The only one where I was like, they shouldn't have done that was on the first drive of the game when it was fourth and four from the 50, and then the Lions marched down. This was before that had happened. If it had been later in the game and Mike McDonald had seen what the defense was like, he might have reacted differently in that situation.
I agree.
So I left the game even despite the fact that the defense got cooked pretty summarily. I left the game equally as excited about the Seahawks team and equally as confident in Mike McDonald and Ryan Grubb. So I honestly it they are not undefeated anymore. They lost a game. I was not upset almost at all. Aside from the only things I was upset about was small refereeing stuff. But it wasn't in the end, like DK caught the 2-point conversion, and I was mad that they didn't review it. But then Mike McDonald did say that they looked at it upstairs and they said it wasn't a catch. And I'm like,
Well, I mean, it makes you wonder how they looked at it, but
oh, I don't agree with their looking at
who
it,
was doing the looking? Was
but it
it
happened, or at least he was told that it happened. But
who
Mike McDonald
refereed?
can't challenge that, can he? It's a scoring play, right? Or can we challenge it?
I don't believe so now. Who refereed Super Bowl 40? Was it Phil Luckett?
If they told him that they looked at it upstairs and it wasn't a catch, it would have been stupid of Mike McDonald to have then challenged it when
I
they're
don't
already
believe
like,
you can't.
or he can't. So I don't agree with that overall. It was close. I think it was a catch, but then immediately after they come back with a 70-yard touchdown, and I'm like, well, I can't get that mad about this.
Oh no, Phil Luckett was the coin toss guy. Who refereed Super Bowl
Oh.
40? The 38 first downs for the Seahawks was the most ever. Bill Levy
Yeah, Bill
was the
Levy.
one who refereed Super Bowl 40, also famously at Ford Field.
Luka during the game, on that 2-point conversion, he was like, I was just yelling about how DK caught the ball, and he was like, it's fine, Dad. He was like, they're getting another play, and I was like, it's not fine. I was like, from the 1-yard line is not as good as having the 2 points. And then they throw the incompletion, which that was actually not a good play call, in my opinion. The fade to Bobo
It
on the
seemed
second one
like
looked
it was
weird.
something that they have in their 2-point repertoire, but it's not a play that's designed to take advantage of being at the
At the
1-yard line
one,
instead of the
yes.
two. So
And
that was a little
then,
disappointing from that standpoint.
so Luke and I were arguing. I yelled, "Learn football!" And he was like, "I like to imagine how different our family is than every other family." It's like you're yelling learned football at me for saying it's okay about a two-point conversion not being.
You know what? I can empathize with both sides of this argument.
I stand by my learned football to him.
I feel like my evaluation of Mike Macdonald as defensive, like, game changer has it's tweaked down a little bit this week. But I agree
sure.
with everything else you're saying that, like, from a big picture game management standpoint, they did a lot of good things. I know there was some question about them not going for two when they scored down nine, having previously done so down eight. There is value. I would probably recommend going for it down nine, because if you're going to need not just a touchdown, but another score, you know, you're not going to be able to do it touchdown and 2-point conversion. There is value in doing that earlier, but there was still a lot of time left. There was scenarios where, you know, a team kicks a field goal, one or the other, and it takes that 8-point situation off the table entirely. It's like a 50.1 to 49.9, and just there's like so much more important stuff to worry about in life that I can't get too concerned about that one.
I agree. But the other play I didn't mention, so I mentioned the DK fumble and then the OPI that they called on Lockett.
You mentioned
realistically
that.
Okay, but that play, it probably was the right call. It's a pretty difficult thing when you're engaging with a defender to differentiate, and they called it on the opposite side of the field. I felt like almost just because they called it on Lockett, on the play that ended up being, would have been Jared Goff's only incompletion. It's still a little bit difficult to parse the difference between blocking and running a route when you're a wide receiver and you're running into players, because it's not like there are no routes that you get engaged with defensively like that. So it was frustrating. It was the absolute right play call by Ryan Grubb, though. Like almost every situation, Ryan Grubb dialed up the right play call. And then, I don't know, it didn't really matter at the end of the game. The game was over at this point when the fast snap happened. But like, it was frustrating at the time. The only play call, there was I think it was third down where he ended up throwing it to DK and it got deflected, was when Geno rolled to his right and there was, it was kind of just unclear what the play was there. You know the play I'm talking about? Geno got it and immediately rolled to his right and there was just kind of a big mess on the right side of the field. And then he came back to the left side. I thought there was going to be somebody wide open when he did. And it was, he threw it up to DK and it got, there's the defender was in front of him. DK had to come back for it.
Yeah, I actually thought that was more plausibly pass interference than the broadcast. Like, the broadcast was all like DK was playing defender on that one. It's like, well, yeah, because he's trying to go catch the football and there's somebody in his way.
Oh, I mean, they could have called pass interference. The one to me that I was most annoyed about was actually, I think this is Terrion Arnold, early in the game when he obviously pass interfered with Tyler Lockett and they were like, just a great play by young corner. And then they're roasting Terrion Arnold for the rest of the game. And I'm like, that was as much of a pass interference as any of these other ones. I don't really know. I think at some point they're just kind of like, he literally was holding Tyler Lockett's arm down. And that was actually, this was when Luke and I started fighting, when he was like, it's not pass interference, Dad. And I'm like, he's holding his arm. How is Tyler supposed to catch the ball? Anyway, the refs didn't lose the Seahawks this game. So I can't, the Seahawks defense lost the Seahawks this game. DK fumbling lost the Seahawks this game. Still played a monster game. DK is having the kind of season that we talked about where DK is finally, he's having another season where he has elevated. There's still going to be some frustrating moments along the way, but he has elevated to one of the best receivers in the NFL.
I mean, Jackson Dozens pointed this out. He's third in the NFL in receiving yards, the first Seahawk ever with 100 plus yards in three consecutive games. Like, he's doing a lot of amazing things. Who is ahead of him? I don't know.
Nico Collins. Nico Collins is a beast.
I assume
it's Nico Collins. I'm like neighbors. I'm not sure if this is updated. I love that Juwan Jennings was third before this, basically because of one game.
The fumble was a minus eight EPA, which is about as high. I mean, I suppose you could have some higher ones if it's like you're about to score and it's a return six of some kind, but that's a pretty, more than a touchdown is a pretty massive amount of points to add on a single play or subtract in this case.
It was also just devastating when it happened. I mean, again, if this, the whole game is different if that doesn't happen. So I left this game. I'm fine with this loss. The Seahawks are a good team. That's all we kind of needed to. We needed to just be like, is this Seahawks team a good team? Are they legit? They're 3-1. They probably should be 3-1 at this point. That is a really fucking hard game. The Lions are awesome.
What percentage chances of victory did you give the Seahawks in this one?
Quite high. But also, this was before all of the defensive. I'm just telling, I mean, they still, for what it's worth, gained 520 yards. Like, I'm not taking the L on my perspective about this game. They gained 516 yards and had the most first downs of any team that lost in a game in NFL history. So I don't think you could frame it as my perspective about my confidence about the team was wrong. Are we ready to talk about the Huskies?
I don't know if I'm emotionally ready to talk about Friday's game.
Because all you could do is trade grades.
I mean,
that happened. It was so much was happening on Friday night. I literally watched the first half of the game at Carbonito Pumpkin Patch just on my phone. I'm like pumping my fist. I'm on the fucking hayride or whatever, and I'm like yelling about things, calling out first downs.
Did you tell any other people's children that they needed to learn football? Or did you just reserve that to for your own children?
I would have. They didn't even know enough to know that they needed to learn football. I Luka's confidence about picking up a 2-point conversion for the 1-yard line was not as high as mine was, if that makes sense.
No, yours was not as high as his.
Sure, yes. He was way too overconfident about picking up a 2-point conversion from the 1-yard line.
Right.
And I have watched enough football to know that you can never count on something happening before it happens.
Really? You've learned from watching Seattle football that having the ball at the 1-yard line doesn't necessarily guarantee a score? I'm just saying.
Still too soon.
For which one? Both?
Actually, it's not. I don't care.
The girl's not here anymore. It's not too soon.
I don't actually care. I sometimes think to myself, though, like, what? It's just fun to imagine what if the Seahawks win that game, what the next 10 years look like. And honestly, the team is probably worse in the second.
But I do think the run maybe goes on a little bit longer.
Possibly. Do they win another Super Bowl? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, they're better than next year.
I mean, we should say while we're here, by the way, our thoughts are with the family of the late Dikembe Mutombo after he passed away. Like, speaking of someone who was involved in a very traumatic moment that we were reminded of a long period of time, because NBC broadcast through the duration of their run featured him on the ground holding the ball in celebration after 94 in the first round upset, first number 8 seed to defeat a number 1. But did time passed, and Dikembe Mutombo became, even to us, I think, a beloved member of the NBA family.
Mutombo.
So,
yeah,
you know, tragic to hear of his passing so young from brain cancer. But back to the Husky game.
Friday, I thought we were going to hit that in toast. I told you about how upset I was 2 years ago about UW losing to UCLA on the road, Kalen DeBoer's first loss at UW. This game on Friday night was so much more frustrating than that game, because in that game, UCLA played well. And in this game, Rutgers basically, like, 2 carries, a small handful of carries, and the announcers could not contain themselves with excitement over Rutgers. No mention of how much UW was dominating this team, really on both sides of the ball. It ended up being, you know, the 3 missed field goals were the story, and obviously the penalty was the story.
Yeah.
UW is not, they are not in the same ballpark skill-wise and with this Rutgers team, and they showed it on Friday night. It was one of the most frustrating losses I've seen. And also the perspective, I was so upset about it because I was like, I feel like I'm in the twilight zone right now and nobody else is seeing just how good this UW team played. They were dominant offensively and they were honestly fairly dominant defensively. They played overall an excellent game of football that was marred by a couple of small pieces that lost them the stupid fucking game in New Jersey. And I'm still mad about it because of, but then time passed and all of a sudden the, were we at, it's like the, were we actually beating that badly Twitter account? And last week UW was on the extreme opposite end because they actually dominated Northwest. This week for teams who lost, they were the team that dominated their opponent the most of any team that lost across the country. This UW team is like a top 15 team in the country, and nobody knows it.
Okay, it's not a top 15 team in the country. We'll talk about that in a second. It was highly predictable. Christian Capel of On Montlake noted in his, I don't know if it was his recap or his day after, like, when that chart comes out, the Huskies are going to be at the extreme left end. Like, they average, we talked about the yards per play. And the Seahawks allowing 7.9 yards per play for the, to the Lions. The Huskies averaged 7.9 yards per play. Rutgers averaged 5.2. They had 222 more total more yards than Rutgers. They did not commit a turnover. There's not a comprehensive college football database online that I know of. Using the StatHead database is with that first downs one. There has never been an NFL game in the history of the league where a team has outgained its opponent by that many yards and not had a turnover and lost the game. And a fun fact, a fun twist, the biggest yards advantage without a turnover in a loss in NFL history belongs to your Seattle Seahawks in a game at St. Louis in 2014. That it took me a second, but then I remembered Austin Davis started at quarterback for the Rams. And this is a game where they returned a punt for a touchdown, I believe on a trick play where they had two returners in and they drew the Seahawks team to the fake returner and not to the real returner who was running untouched up the sidelines for a touchdown. Do you remember this?
We watched this at your house, right?
No, we watched it at Katie's.
Okay.
This was, what's our special teams coordinator's name? Fossil, John Fossil. This was the ultimate John Fossil game because they had both that and also Johnny and Hecker passing for to convert a fourth down.
I remember that. Oh my God. So, so this would have been one of the most lopsided losses. It might have been the most lopsided losses statistically in NFL history.
This would have been the most lopsided statistical loss in NFL history.
Ah! I felt that way the whole game. And Kayleen was like, why are you yelling so much? And it's not just, if we'd been getting crushed, I would have been frustrated. But there's something so singular about being way better and still losing and having to listen to these fucking broadcasters talk about, like, them comparing Jonah Coleman. Jonah put some goddamn respect on his name, Coleman, and Kyle Manungai, 4 yards per carry better than Kyle Manungai. And they're like, well, they're two good running backs. And I'm like, there's one elite running back and there's a 6th-round pick on the field right now. These two players are not in the same world as each other. Jonah Coleman's one of the best running backs I've ever seen.
I don't know how high you think running backs get drafted. The 6th-round pick can be that different from anyone else.
Sure, but like, it was a fine game. I left that game.
I also like to be fair to both Kyle Manungai and the broadcast crew, it was impressive because he was doing this with Ethan Kalia-Akmanis.
No.
14 of 24 passes for 115 yards. And the Huskies,
that would be true,
loading the box,
if they didn't go out of their way to also compliment Kalia-Akmanis. And I'm like, is nobody seeing this? Am I the only person who sees
broadcast.
What's going on?
It's a positive broadcast. So obviously a lot of what happened were the missed field goals. I mean, there were two missed field goals, like the miss at the end of the game. Like that was always an extreme long shot scenario, but the 38 yarder in particular, frustrating. And then the penalty, as you mentioned, on the blocked field goal. Rutgers, the wild thing is, so they had three drives in the entire game of more than four plays.
Are you kidding me? That's for real?
Yeah.
Oh,
they had three drives in the entire game
of
more than four plays. They converted them all into touchdowns. The Huskies had, you know, I don't know how many times they were in the red zone specifically, but they had, between missed field goals and touchdowns, they had 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, in the 4th and 1, 5, 6, 7. They had 7 possessions where they got in the red zone, I believe.
I can't even. There were some of these plays where Rutgers punted where I was like, man, probably should have gone for that one, guys.
Oh, yeah. Without question. I mean, Greg Schiano was a huge part of the Huskies staying in this game.
Overall, I mean, this is the thing that has been frustrating about this team because they've outplayed every single team they played this year.
I mean, first off, special teams are real. They do exist. They don't show up in that chart, but they matter. And the Huskies remain extraordinarily bad at special teams, inexplicably bad at special teams. And like Grady Gross has been a good kicker over the course of his time at UW. Of what happened on a Friday night in Piscataway, I don't know.
I mean, I think the second field goal, the first one, what was the situation? Fourth and three at the Rutgers 4. Oh no, he made that one. Okay.
Yeah, that was the 22-yarder from the angle.
Should have gone for that. The missed field goal was fourth and seven at the Rutgers 25. That's kind of a maybe.
That's not a maybe. That's a kick situation.
And this one, okay, so it was 21-10, fourth and five at the Rutgers 20. I thought they should have gone for that one. So
probably
with the way that the offense had been moving the ball, I'm like, why are you kicking here? Grady Gross already missed one. And he, of course, missed all three. I think he had the leg on the third one, for what it's worth.
Sure, but you know, it's a kick that's 4 yards longer than any he's ever made in his career, or 3 yards or whatever it is. Like, you can't expect him.
I'm not saying that I was expecting it. The second field was the one that was frustrating that he missed. I don't want to, it's not about blaming Grady Gross. It's that, how did these situations not turn into touchdowns? And there still were a couple of penalties, whether they were legit or not, that put them behind the ball, that meant that they had to fight back to get into those situations. And just not the way that Ryan Grubb, and I think this is ultimately the difference between right now, between Jed Fish and Ryan Grubb. I mean, Kalen DeBoer, I'm fine with the number one and two teams in the country having former UW coaches be their coach. It's impressive the talent that has come through Motlick. I still think if Kalen DeBoer had blown that with that lead, it would have been, I think there would have been a lot of whispers around Tuscaloosa. But the difference between Jed Fish and Ryan Grubb is Ryan Grubb is a better situational play caller than Jed Fish is. And Ryan Grubb, in the way in this game earlier today, he dialed up the right play in the right situation. And I think Jed Fish, and it might even be that Jed Fish hasn't quite gotten a grasp of the team overall. For the Seahawks, this is an offense that has been together, mostly the same offense, for quite a few years. Geno Smith is an extraordinarily experienced quarterback. Will Rogers is also experienced, but Jed Fish, it's basically brand new pieces all around. Everybody is brand new. So Jed Fish may still be figuring out the offense a little bit. The situational play calling hasn't been exactly right. And that's the piece that they need to figure out, because they have to stop kicking fucking field goals. Whether if it's an absolutely obvious situation, even if it means that they're, and I actually felt like on the first series of the game, they went for it. And I was just like, I've almost never seen a coach go for it in that situation, because I'm watching, I'm at Carpenito Farms, the children are in the corn pit. And I'm like, this is probably a go situation, because what do you gain by?
Right.
By punting at 15 yards, something, and then they go for it. They also dialed up some deep shots on fourth down in a way that there was one that they hit to Denzel later in the game where I was like, whoo, okay, that was a little scary. Like, maybe take the short one. But the way that the Seahawks were able to get the ball to Tyler Lockett, to JSN, to pick up first downs, to roll Geno out into space, hit tight ends for those first downs, the Huskies haven't exactly figured that out right now. And I think that is the final piece to the puzzle for them to turn these drives, these yards per play that we're talking about, into touchdowns, so that we're not losing to goddamn trash Rutgers on a Friday night.
I mean, I think, you know, the Rutgers other element of it sucks. Is like, anytime you break things into a smaller sample size, whether it's plays in the red zone or third downs as opposed to first and second down and any of that, like, there's going to be more variance. The sample size is inherently smaller. So, you know, maybe he had dialed up the perfect play on, you know, what was the, it was a fourth down in the red zone where there was some sort of miscommunication between him and Denzel Boston, right? Denzel Boston ran the wrong route. Am I remembering that correctly? I don't know.
Fourth down?
they all run together for me at some point, especially when you're busy figuring out which of the Knicks and Timberwolves to give a B plus and which to give a B.
Fourth and goal from the Rutgers too.
Yeah.
I do not honestly remember what that play call was, but that probably, I mean, that's a situation where it was right to go for it, but we just haven't turned these into touchdowns. It has been consistent. Literally, they make the right play call or execute the right play call against Wazoo. I saw it on Sunday. There's who, I can't remember which team it was. Maybe it was the Steelers. And it's just like the play call in that situation is you fake the run up the middle because they have to defend that. If you have Jonah Coleman on the field, you have to overload and defend that. And you leak out a tight end. And then you throw the easy touchdown to the tight end. Like, it's not rocket science. That shit works all the time. And their teams don't use it enough. And again, like, if you imagine it from the situation of, well, they'll just defend that. It's like, if Jonah Coleman's on the field, you have to do everything you can to stop the player who's averaging almost 10 yards per carry. And the way that Jonah Coleman gets to the second level, like, again, I don't think I've ever seen a running back like Jonah Coleman. He's incredible. He wears down a little bit.
That's because you weren't around for Napoleon Kaufman.
Well, I mean, I was thinking Corey Dillon was probably the more... The way that...
Corey Dillon was different because, like, Jonah Coleman, the thing is, he's like 5'7 or whatever he is. Corey Dillon was just like... It was like the senior is playing against the freshman.
But Jonah Coleman is sturdy.
I'm not disputing Jonah Coleman's sturdiness. I'm just saying, like, Corey Dillon was just like, he was so much bigger than everyone who was trying to tackle him. And I don't think that's the case with Jonah Coleman. Like, he's very powerful.
Anyway, it was an extraordinarily frustrating loss because of all of those things. How many, and then obviously the penalty after the play. I throw up my hands because that ultimately was the game. If that doesn't happen, the Huskies win this game.
Jonah Coleman is 5'9", but Corey Dillon was 6'1". Presumably still is. Yeah, I mean...
The most annoying thing, though, is that people talk about the special teams, say what you will. Maybe Jed Fish doesn't care about special teams. I don't know.
I think he does. Again, the special teams have been bad at UW statistically for a long period of time, and I don't understand why it is.
Maybe it's the a batter's eye.
I haven't seen stats on the opponent special
Maybe
teams.
Maybe it's the 6:40 start time
at Husky Stadium.
But the idea of undisciplined, and that's what the takeaway was from this game. Undisciplined. I'm like, do you think Jed Fish is like, get out there, boys, go celebrate on the field?
The play is get on the field now.
I'm like,
it's not that
a freshman ran onto the field. No coach is stopping that. Something crazy shit happens.
I do.
You think there's coaches? I think Kalen DeBoer was like, "Hey, we don't step on the field until the play is over."
That's not it. No. Just keep stop talking. You're missing the point.
Okay.
What you do is you have a coach standing in front of the players. That's what you do. It's called a get back coach.
And you think Jed Fish just hadn't thought of that?
I guess not. I mean, I don't know that. Like, I mean, I don't think you have that in the same degree. But like in the NBA, because of the fact that players are suspended or coming onto the court during an altercation, there is an assistant coach whose job, whose duty in that situation is to run out there and put themselves in front of the players to make sure that they do not leave the bench area. Like, that is an assigned thing. And like, if there was a team that didn't do that, there would be a problem. So I do think there's probably some degree. Now, the funny thing, of course, is if there is any coach in the world who has thought about these things and put thought into what are the littlest rules that I can take advantage of to win, his son happens to be the defensive coordinator of this team.
Who's on? I'm so excited. We'll talk about Michigan later. I am so excited to see Steve Belichick's defense against Michigan.
I'm very curious to see how it's going to go.
It could be a massive wake-up call. Like, I don't think Rutgers is a good team. Rutgers happened to beat Virginia Tech, who also happened to be close with Miami. But
I think that Rutgers might have a stronger passing attack than Michigan. We'll get there.
I mean, just the offensive line, like the way that Michigan's line is going to be able to push around UW's defense, I think is different. But we'll see.
There's going to be more guys in the box than there were last week.
I'm very fascinated to see that. I think that the Huskies have kind of, I mean, literally they lost this game because of two plays. I mean, there's a lot more, like missed field goals, not scoring that touchdown, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To me, it came down to Vincent Holmes runs onto the field after that. Never in my entire life have I seen. Can you think of a time you've seen that happen before?
No. Oh, no, absolutely not.
It was like, there was a penalty, and I would just assumed it was post-play. I was like, the block will count, we're fine. There's a post-play celebration penalty. I did not imagine that it would be something that would extend the drive. It didn't, literally, I could not think of what it could have been if they weren't offsides or held or something. It was shocking to see. They made a great play. And then you want to talk about special teams. They made a special teams play there also.
They did. It just
a game-changing special
count.
Teams play. But the special teams did it. Vincent Holmes wasn't even on the goddamn field.
I'm just saying, it didn't show up in the stats.
And then on the final touchdown drive for Rutgers, on the final drive of more than four plays for Rutgers, there was a face mask.
I believe that was the final play of more than three drive of more than three plays. There was only one four play drive. Everything else was a three and out.
A completely phantom face mask that put the Huskies on the wrong side of it. It advanced Rutgers to the other side of the field, and it put them on the other side of the ball. And then they have the touchdown up the middle.
Yeah, I didn't see this because I was trying to figure out the Minnesota Timberwolves tax bill.
So those two plays, if they don't call that, and I'm sorry, but like undisciplined, Steve Belichick and Jed Fish are not like tackle him by the face mask, guys. That's legal. Just reach up into their face area. It's just shit has happened to them. Undisciplined is something totally different to me than what UW has happened. I actually don't even know what it means. Undisciplined is like they're fighting with people on the field.
Yeah, I mean, and I do think it's a number
DK
of
Metcalf
personal fouls.
At times has been undisciplined. But UW is not... Actually, they made some really fucking stupid plays. Offensive linemen. They were close. They were 50-50 plays where it was like... There was like people on the ground, and then I can't remember which offensive
lineman
was jumped on the
pile. The first drive killing third down penalty.
What are you doing, dude?
A late hit, but
you
again,
don't
need
to do that.
And it wasn't even that they had a lot of penalties in this game. They got called for six penalties for 69 yards. It's not an abnormal number of penalties. It's just that
extraordinarily brutal.
Obviously, the Vincent Holmes penalty happened to give Rutgers 7 points and potentially take away points from the Huskies, given, you know, they would have had a chance to score before the end of the half had they taken possession. And then the offensive penalties, both that late hit that you referenced, which I believe was by D'Angelo Titiale, so like a fifth year senior. And then you had the Cam Davis illegal block. Those both took them to unconvertible third down situations and ended up costing them points.
Yep. We need to work on some lateral situations for thirds and longs. I mean, I think we're going to see it a lot more. NFL teams.
Oh.
Again, but there's also, this is what I think about when I'm like flag football. I'm like, you set up a thing and then you also have like reversions around that, right? So if you have Jackson Smith and Jigba and it's like he's in the middle of the field lateraling it to Zach Charbonnet, they now, the defenders, have to go to Zach Charbonnet and that opens up space on the field. We can have laterals everywhere.
You know, one more thing on the Seahawks game. Like, obviously, DK Metcalf was by far the most important receiver in this game, and Tyler Lockett had some big moments, OPAI aside. Still, there's nobody I feel more confident when Geno Smith is throwing him the ball on third or fourth down than JSN, which is very exciting
JSN.
For a second-year receiver. So, just wanted to note that.
Anyway, two teams went and played football in New Jersey this last Friday. One team was phenomenal overall throughout the run of the game. One team was Rutgers, and they happened to win. And it was very frustrating to see. I think Jed is going to figure it out. It does not make me nervous at all going forward. And in fact, there's a little part of us that these people, I think people are too out of control with Jed trying to leave or whatever. And I'm like, this motherfucker just got here. He bought a house. Like, it still is. It's not that fun to move your family across the country over and over and over again. He seems comfortable with it. He's been a lot of places, but the ping ponging back and forth. If there is a situation, well, I mean, the Florida job is almost certainly going to open up this year. If the Florida job opens and Jed Fish is just fine at UW, that is me fan base. And if it does mean that Jed Fish has a statistically excellent season and we have to wait a year, like, I'll take, I mean, Arizona got a big win Like, I don't think Will Rogers is like a singularly great quarterback. I think with Damon Williams next year, maybe plus somebody else, I trust this offense just as much. I like the way that he mixes in Damon. The run game is excellent. Jonah Coleman has another year of eligibility if he's back. I am so ready. I love this UW team.
Yeah, I'm not counting on Jonah Coleman being back, but Adam Mahomes is quite excited as well.
Oh, Adam Mahomes great too. We have so many good running backs. There are some series where I'm like, can we just get the Jonah here? I'm like, I love Cam Davis. I love Adam Mahomes, but like Jonah is at a different level right now. But maybe Adam Mahomes will be there.
Cam Davis had some great broken tackles in this.
Oh, the run game, I don't know. I'm very much looking forward to Saturday.
We'll talk about that in a bit. All right. With that, let's get to this week's toasts. First up, a congratulations to the Seattle Sounders for clinching their 15th playoff berth in 16 seasons of existence with Saturday's win over Houston. It goes without saying that once again, as has always been the case, there can be one of the Sounders and the Mariners in the playoffs any given year. There can never be none, and there can never be two. Only one at any given point since the Sounders came into existence.
I like that you're like, these things cannot happen at the same time. It really is just the Sounders make the playoffs a lot, and the Mariners don't really make the playoffs.
But it is amazing that there's only one year ever where the Sounders haven't made the playoffs, and that happened to be the one year in the past 23 and counting, or 22 and counting, or whatever you want to say it, that the Seattle Mariners have made the playoffs.
Yes, I'll agree with that.
Also, congrats on the Sounders being named a host for the FIFA Club World Cup in 2025, meaning at a minimum, all three Sounders group stage matches will be played at Lumen Field during June 2025. That draw is expected to happen in December, so very exciting stuff.
Wait, can you say that all entirely one more time? Because I was not listening. I didn't hear what you said, but I was curious.
They have been named a host for the FIFA Club World Cup in 2025, for which they qualified by winning the CONCACAF Champions League, meaning at a minimum, they'll host all three Sounders group stage matches, which will be played at Lumen Field during June 2025. And the draw for that is expected to happen in December, so we'll know which teams are headed to Seattle.
And what types of teams are in that? Is this a tournament that, like, is it the winner of, like, the Euro? Not the Euro,
The Champions League.
The Champions League.
UEFA Champions League. That's what they call
Europa League is the other one, right? That's what I mean to say.
So it has been expanded. It used to be just the single continental champion of each continent plus the host and maybe one other team. I have to do the math. I think there's 8 teams traditionally. Now there's, I believe, going to be 24, maybe 32. So there's going to be a lot of teams involved.
Soccer really is, why don't we just build the whole season out of random tournaments?
Yeah, there's also,
like, people love random tournaments. Why not have numerous of them?
Our friends at Sounder at Heart, their blog post about this noted that there is some ongoing potential FIFA Pro talk of a strike based on fixture congestion. And I understand why players be getting upset that there's just increasing numbers of games in this sport that we learn more and more about how damaging it is to play frequently to athletes. But, you know, if they are going to play more games, it's good that they play them in Seattle.
They might as well play them in Seattle. Fair enough. That's the Pelton Cast way. Do you know if teams take this seriously, though?
Historically, they've taken it fairly seriously. I think in the past it was played as a preseason tournament for the, you know, teams that play in the traditional winter season. In this case, it will be played at the end of their season, so it seems a little less likely they'll take it as seriously, but we'll see.
Okay.
Congrats to the Storm's Ezzy Magbegor for being named All-Defensive First Team, Nneka Ogwumike Second Team. Magbegor finished third in Defensive Player of the Year voting, receiving 3 votes. And lastly this week, congrats to Mark Stewart and the Ballard Shinglers for winning the Pelton Cast Fantasy Baseball League.
Really?
Yeah.
By really, I meant there's a Pelton Cast Fantasy Baseball League?
There is. The listener, Noah Cohen, is doing a lot of work putting these leagues together. Fantasy NBA, I don't know if we still need one. I should have checked in on that. We might still need one. So if you are not in that and desire to play, let me know, and we'll see if there's still a spot.
Is Tim or Rob playing in that?
Yes.
Both?
I believe just Tim, but
okay. But you participate in that also.
No. He asked me at the game, "Do you play fantasy NBA?" And I'm like, "Oh no, there's nothing more tedious to me than fantasy NBA."
Lee, I thought you did. You just do WNBA?
Correct.
Okay.
Only in leagues where I feel like I should be able to win every year. And
And
then fantasy
yet you
football.
play fantasy football.
And fantasy football, to be clear. Because fantasy football is like a well-designed, like, yeah, it makes sense. Each team plays once a week, as opposed to like I have to shuffle my roster from Tuesday to a Wednesday because this team is on a back-to-back and this team isn't. Like, that's the worst. I can only do it for the WNBA.
That sounds horrible. What did I do? Oh my God. I just it's the most frustrating part about fantasy football is when you finally have a good week and then your opponent has freaking Derrick Henry at a 36. You're just like, for real?
Wouldn't know what it's that's like this week.
I drew up Jaden Daniels. Really, the Anthony Richardson in both leagues was maybe not a great decision.
You win some, you lose some. All right, no hot takes this week, but the Mariners season has officially concluded. They were eliminated during their off day on Thursday, played out the string by sweeping the Oakland A's over the weekend. But it's already time to look ahead to 2025 in the upcoming offseason. Jerry Dipoto gave an interview during the final weekend and was asked a few questions, first on salaries for young players going up, some notable answers at least. That's going to jump payroll quite a bit anyway, but it won't be the only rise that we see in payroll. I can't give you an exact number. I don't know what that is. I can tell you we're not going the other way.
Okay.
And then was asked about trading a starting pitcher for an impact hitter. On the continuum of A to Z, that would be plan Z times some denominator. We could shoot ourselves in the foot by getting too crafty in what we do. Our pitching is how we are built.
Okay.
Dynamite drop, man.
I don't have a strong take on that. I kind of think he's I think there's a little bit of the value of a young pitcher. I can't even really think of like major league caliber star young pitcher gets traded for major league caliber hitter
Yeah,
type trade.
we talked about this a few weeks ago. It is difficult to find examples.
So it's a little bit of like, yes, I agree that Jerry DePoto is not exactly saying, he's saying that's something that they won't do, but he's not unpacking the rest of why they won't do it. And there's probably a reality that the types of hitters that we're thinking of, those hitters are not available for the Mariners pitching.
I agree, that's
So
probably true.
the it kind of answers itself. I mean, I guess I wrote hot takes and decided I didn't really have a clear enough perspective on it because I just don't, this is the exact opposite of Mariners hot takes intent. I feel like I sometimes like care a little bit too much to be able to write hot takes anymore, but I just don't know what they should do, if that makes sense. I don't have a strong feeling about it overall. I also don't blame Jerry DePoto for most everything, but the hottest take is basically this is it. This is the roster. The moves that people are wanting to have happen happened. It was Randy Arozarena. It was Victor Robles. It's this pitching staff, and you pray that Julio gets better next year. You hope that Cal Raleigh continues to play the way he was, and you hope that the bullpen regresses to the mean overall. But that's it, more or less. There's not going to be a, we're going to pay attention, so much attention to transact this offseason because that's what we do. I'm not going to go into a third consecutive offseason expecting there to be this overwhelming positive transact for the Mariners, because that is just not built into who this front office and who this ownership group is. That is not how they're going to approach things. It is going to be on the edges. And you look at the prospects that they have, we could get super excited about them, but looking at how, I mean, Tyler Locklear was the best of these players, and maybe he'll have an impact to the major league level, but Cole Emerson, Harry Ford, those players are probably not a year away. It is probably not 2025 that they're going to have the impact at a major league level. I would love to be wrong about that, but the
I think
way
it
that
would be surprising if none of the Mariners prospect, if we had a repeat of this one. Cole Young also in the mix here.
the way that Colt Emerson hit at double A right now, or maybe I was looking at Cole Young, how he hit at double A, because Colt Emerson is further. How Cole Young and Harry Ford hit in Arkansas this last year was not, they were fine. They looked like Mariners stats in double A. And maybe that's good enough, but neither of them are demanding to be in the majors.
Cole Young hit 271. There wasn't a ton of power associated with that. I don't know what the Texas League offensive environment looked like. I mean, I see Tyler Locklear's stats.
Tyler Locklear hit a lot better.
But he also only played 41 games.
Colt Emerson is probably another year or two away. And Cole Young feels like, I just, if we're expecting it to come from the minors, I don't think that is a reasonable expectation. Going into next season,
Kevin Polkovich's son at double A?
The rotation is going to look like the rotation. We hope for another year of health. Randy Arozarena is the deal. And that's what we're going to hear this offseason, is that Randy is the offseason acquisition. Having a full year of him, it's kind of right, and it's probably... And there'll be a couple of moves again along the edges, but this is the roster. And I think the hope is that, I mean, I went and looked at Ken Griffey's stats compared to Julio's stats. These two players are not in the same fucking world as each other overall. Like, Ken Griffey Jr. is just, it was a different era and he was playing in the Kingdom, but Ken Griffey Jr. is a lot better than Julio Rodriguez probably will ever be. And I think the hope is that
I mean, Ken Griffey Jr. is one of the top 25 greatest players of all time.
I was curious if there was a season when he was young where it was a little down. And I think the best comparison would be Griffey's 92 season, which is fine. He was 22 years old and was better than Julio's now, but it wasn't a clear, like, he was good and then got better and then got better and then got elite. Julio is not anywhere near his prime yet. There's probably 2 to 3 years before Julio's in his prime. His prime is not going to be as good as Ken Griffey Jr.'s prime was. If his prime is better than he was last year, the Mariners are a playoff team.
Caden Polkovich is the son of one-time Pirates shortstop Kevin Polkovich, one of my favorites.
So
back when we were collecting baseball cards.
That is the timeline. Is they make a couple of moves. They hope that they hit on a few of these things. They hope that Julio next year is better than Julio was this year. And even if we have the Julio in August, September for a full season, that's probably a good enough team to make the playoffs overall. So I feel like that's kind of the blueprint for the Mariners. And I don't think they're wrong. That's why it's kind of like, I don't have hot takes about this, because should they go spend money on Alex Bregman? Probably not. Like, they're not going to sign Juan Soto. So ultimately, most of the free agents don't make that big of a difference.
I mean, the answer with all of these questions is, well, what does it cost? So, like, I can't render a specific
opinion. It's not cheap. That's what I can tell you. None of the players that we're talking about that people want the Mariners to make a play for are, you're going to find a steal on. And that's what the Mariners are looking for.
But to me, the fundamental thing here about the Mariners is, like, they finished seventh in the AL in run differential ahead of the Tigers. They finished, you know, one game back in the standings of both the Tigers and the Royals. They didn't end up missing out on tiebreakers, but we were very close to it. They were three games back of the Astros. Like, they were a perfectly good enough team to make the playoffs that just didn't make the playoffs. And yes, that is a uniquely Mariners thing to do over the course of their history, to be, you know, the sixth best team when there's five teams that make the playoffs, or the eighth best team when there's seventh best team when there's six teams that make the playoffs, whatever the cut line may be. But, like, this idea that we have to go find, like, looking for what's the culprit here, and it's like, it's not anything. Like, things, they just ended up slightly on the wrong side of the line, and that happens. Like, yeah, it would be great if they were the Yankees and you didn't have to worry as much about that because you were, you know, 56 runs in differential clear of everyone else in the league. But they're not the Yankees. And guess what? The Yankees did have this season last year. So, I mean, it's unfortunate that it happened in a year where the starting pitching was as healthy as it was and as effective as it was, even if I think it was overrated.
That's what I'm saying. Statistically, people just seeing, like, the broadcast or whatever it, like I'm watching like fucking King Five, and they're like the Mariners wasted a year, one of the best pitching staffs in baseball, and it's kind of like kind of.
I, for one, am amazed that people aren't applying park factors on, on
that's,
broadcast
that,
TV.
But that's really what it is. It's like sort of, I don't know, kind of. The pitching staff is good.
All right, so let's talk about the offseason. Mariners have only two true free agents, Justin Turner and Jimmy Garcia. Their two trade deadline pickups are both out of contract. They have a $12 million team option on Jorge Polanco that they seem very likely to decline. And then Mitch Haniger has a $15.5 million player option that there was an old dunked on bid. I don't know. I don't know if he's going to pick that up. I think he likely will. They're notable arbitration eligible players when we were talking about those players who are getting raises. Randy Arroz Arena is heading into his second year after making $8.1 million in his first year. Logan Gilbert heading into his second year after making $4.05 million in his first year and having a season that will, I think, likely get him a lot of Cy Young votes. Then George Kirby and Cal Raleigh are both eligible for the first time this year. There you go. Hot stove league time.
It's just honestly, the crazy thing about it was the Mariners have probably the most fun, one of the most fun outfields in baseball, and the Mariners managed to make them dull.
I mean,
I'm excited about a full season of it. I guess we just need Julio to be Julio, and that's kind of it. If all of the rest of the pieces are the same. And Julio is two wins better overall, probably in the playoffs. And I think people will point to games at the end of the season, but ultimately, the season was lost not because of one random game in September. It's a cumulative effect of getting swept by the Angels and losing so... Obviously, the Tigers ended up being... They weren't that good, you know? And the way that the Tigers just absolutely dominated the Mariners, that... Every single other team who is in the conversation for the wild card had the tiebreaker over the Mariners. That
is weird.
They just weren't good enough. Like, that's kind of what it is. You look at it overall, and they probably were slightly unlucky by run differential for not making the playoffs, but not that unlucky. And the offseason moves, some were good, some were bad. Like, this is a baseball season, and there's a reality that it gets a lot worse. We paid attention to these fuckers till basically the end, until the last week of the season. We fought more in the Discord. There is way more conversation about the Mariners than there is any other team. And this
maybe all the other teams combined
probably will still be the same. And it's funny because people are like, oh, all, like, we treat it like winning and losing is what matters. There's no matter. If the team wins the World Series, we don't get anything, right? We buy a t-shirt or something. We have memories. If the team makes the playoffs, there's a parade shirt. It's kind of annoying, actually, but you feel like you have to go. And like the actual tangible benefit to anybody of the team making the playoffs is on spending money. Maybe you watch the games. Like, those things are fun. I agree that those things are fun. But what baseball is, it is a 162-game grind that you do, and you hope to pay attention to the point that we paid attention to. We paid attention like four less days than we would have liked to. And if they sneak into the playoffs and then lose then, it doesn't last for that much longer. So I'm just like, ultimately, for what we're looking for from a baseball season, nobody's going to say this. All those people who are at the park who are complaining about it or whatever about the season, you still bought tickets, dude. Like, you were still there spending money on this baseball team. And there's a reality that this is the point of it. The arguing is the point of baseball. The people complaining about it, wins and losses are not actually it. Us being able to fight about it and the decisions that they make and how they should assemble the roster, that's kind of it. So,
and you said you didn't have any takes. By the way, did you see the art but make it sports of the hot dogs from heaven?
No.
It was the descent of the Holy Spirit. It's so good.
We also,
it's perfect.
I personally think, obviously, like, ownership and the front office wanted to make the playoffs, but to John Stanton, this season was a W.
I don't agree with that. Attendance was down this season.
Was it really?
Yeah.
I think attendance was fine.
It was fine, but I do think there is a reality that hopefully they have learned the lesson that you do have to spend
What
some money
lesson,
to make
though?
money.
What did they not? That's what I'm always trying to understand. It's like, what did they not do? I mean, we could pick out players, I guess, but like, what did they not do for not spending money to make money? Because
I mean,
they
first
weren't
off,
going to spend
I
a
don't
lot
know
of money.
who baseball players are. And especially at the scale that we're actually talking about, because it's not, you love to point out Juan Soto. The answer is, who could 5 million more had gotten them instead of Jorge Polanco? That's the question. And I have no idea who the answer is, because that would require me to know second baseman on Major League Baseball team. I was excited about the Mets game today because it's like, ah, Edwin Diaz, Ryan Stanek, I know these guys.
Yeah. Make the whole league out of former Mariners relievers.
All right, let's get on to the roundup.
Okay. Fuck the Mariners.
Seattle Kraken.
It's a good season, though. Come on.
Got their first and thus far only preseason win last Friday versus Vancouver with Joey Decord in net for a 3-1 win. The offense kept percolating in a 5-4 loss at Edmonton and then a 4-3 overtime loss Monday night at Calgary. They'll wrap things up Wednesday versus Edmonton. We are T-minus, I believe, 8 days from Kraken opening night as we do this. So I don't know that we're going to have a real Kraken preseason preview here, but... Oh, it's not an opening night. That's right, this year, because they're part of the ESPN triple header. It will be an opening day on Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. on ESPN against the St. Louis Blues next week. So mark your calendars appropriately.
I did look up Vegas odds for the Stanley Cup to look up New York Rangers odds, of course. And I had to scroll very far to get to the Kraken for Stanley Cup odds. I think they were fourth or fifth worst. It was pretty low, so I think expectations, at least from Vegas, are not super high on the season.
Not terribly surprising. All right, Seattle Sounders, we mentioned at the top that they clinched a playoff berth with a 1-0 win Saturday against the Houston Dynamo. Paul Rothrock scored the game's only goal in the 22nd minute. Sounders allowed just one shot on goal and seven shots total as Houston managed a piddling 0.3 xG to 1.34 the Sounders. The win jumped the Dynamo into a tie for fifth in the West standings with Colorado. Rapids would currently win that by virtue of having one more win, but the teams play Saturday in Colorado. Before that, the Sounders will travel to face Vancouver, who's 3 points back with one match in hand. Sounders have yet to beat the Whitecaps this season with a road loss and a home draw. They also drew Colorado at home back in March. One more bit of Sounders news, they signed defender Jackson Reagan, Seattle product, to an extension through 2027 with a club option for 2028. So nice to have him part of this core for the foreseeable future. Seattle Reign put just three of their 13 shots on goal in a 1-0 home loss to Bay FC that just about ends their playoff hopes. Reign are now 8 points back of Bay FC for the eighth and final spot with four matches to play and wouldn't be guaranteed to make it even if they win out.
Tied for eighth worst for the Kraken, plus 6,600. Do you know that this upcoming NHL season, there is a team called the Utah Hockey Club?
I do know that fact, yes.
I love the name Hockey Club. I am so all in. The Washington football team, favorite name of all time.
So you think they should just stick with it? I still struggle to call them the Commanders. I want to call them the Washington football team.
They are the Washington football team. That's what they are. More expository names.
I mean, it'd be better if it was Washington team football, because WTF would be an appropriate acronym. Although maybe not anymore.
No, we love
good
the Commanders.
Now.
I'm just like, I want Dan Quinn to do well.
And Cliff Kingsbury?
Yeah. It's so weird. Time. You can hate somebody for a long time. Time passes and you're like, Cliff seems like a pretty good guy. You know what? It's just like people have earned this overall. Seeing there was a talk about Lane Kiffin's Wikipedia page. And you're just like, you know what? Lane Kiffin's been through a lot of different lives. And over time, Lane Kiffin's kind of grown up in front of all of us. And he probably was an asshole most of the time. But
now he's a fun asshole.
Yeah. You're just like, you know what? Like, society has put you through some things. And Cliff Kingsbury has done the same. So why not cheer for Cliff Kingsbury?
So anyway, Seattle Reign FC, we'll try to get back on track Friday night. I like that you're paying attention. Hosting Angel City FC in a matchup of two teams on the outside of the playoffs looking in. All right, Seattle Storm news. The league announced Monday that the Golden State Valkyries expansion draft will take place on December 6th. Teams will be able to protect six players, including those on the roster and those whose rights they hold. But notably, unrestricted free agents who are not eligible for the core designation cannot be taken by the Valkyries. They can select one unrestricted free agent with the potential to core them. So that may force the Storm to protect Gabby Williams, but Nneka Ogwumike is not eligible for the expansion draft. And what that means is the Storm could protect their other four starters, plus Jordan Horstin and Nika Mühl, and leave only unrestricted free agents from their bench available to the Valkyries, along with their 2024 third-round pick, Mackenzie Holmes, who did not join the team this season while rehabbing knee surgery. So basically, the Storm, unless for some reason they want to, will not lose anyone of note in the expansion
Okay.
draft. It was kind of funny at the exit day last week. We recorded the exit interviews last week. We recorded before this. There was a lot of questions to the players about the expansion draft, and it's like it's not, I don't think it really is on their top of mind for them
It's
right
like
now.
you're gonna hear about this later. It's like me explaining to the children in flag football the situation that's going on.
I mean, I'm sure they're aware that the expansion draft is coming, but they're not
But just
like,
like they're not sitting around thinking about it that much.
they're not sweating out. Am I going to end up having to go to the Valkyries?
That's for the nerds.
Wow. You say that as if one person on this podcast has recorded a mock expansion draft podcast.
That's
That's
your
what.
favorite thing to do.
Oh, it is. And they're not going to release a protected list, so we get to do some mock drafts and like, no one can tell us we were wrong.
I was skeptical about the name Valkyries because we were talking about I just the it they play in San Francisco.
Correct.
So I maybe the Golden State women's basketball team. That doesn't quite feel right.
It's kind of like does not have the ring that Utah Hockey Club. Because also the part of it is that Utah is so short that it's okay to have the three.
Washington football team works great though.
That's true.
I also, are you aware? Can you define Valkyrie for me?
No. It's some
Well,
sort of a mythical creature. Norse? Is it Norse? Or is that Kraken is strictly Norse?
we're honestly getting pretty close to it. In Norse mythology, a Valkyrie
Oh.
is one of a host of female figures who guide souls of the dead to God Odin's Hall of Valhalla. There, the deceased warriors become single fighters or ones fighters.
Okay. I'm
Yeah.
going to take points for that. Should we preview the Huskies in Michigan?
We've got no Husky men's basketball updates because I the you know the seasons are changing. We don't need to have an update on it, but
I
I'm
don't
just
believe we do yet.
I it's tingling for me. I'm feeling it in the air. I
Is
saw
it?
the list of honestly, this is the most excited I've been about Husky men's basketball in a long time.
The great Osabor is the best senior in the country.
Number one. I wouldn't say he's a good Osabor. I would say that he's a great Osabor, and I cannot wait to watch him play basketball this year. It is Sprinkle's house
Yeah,
on Motley.
I would tell you my metrics do not have him as the number one senior in the country. I think Cameron Judds of Marquette, who is also on that list, probably tops it for me.
Where's Great Osabor?
I don't know specifically, but not nearly that high.
Just it you can't tell me it's not one of the most exciting. And now that it's fun when seasons are ending, right? We're wrapping up all sorts of seasons. The Rain are
We
done.
are.
The Rain
Yeah.
are mostly done. The Sounders have clinched the playoffs. The Mariners season is over. The Storm season is over. The Husky season is over because they lost to Rutgers.
The
No,
cookie search is paused.
have we paused?
No, not officially.
I plan on eating more cookies.
We will have some cookie talk on your podcast feed soon. I can guarantee you that, but it's not going to be part of, I mean, it is going to be part of our search for Seattle's best cookie, but it's a discussion of a location that we have already reviewed. So
The cookie search is paused.
consider that.
Anyway, I'm feeling that Husky men's basketball is coming soon. It's one of the things that always sneaks up on you. But let's preview a national championship rematch between UW and Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, you can feel like it's basically a repeat of the national championship game, except for the head coaches. All of the starting offensive skill position players, both defensive coordinators, but Sharon Moore, he still is there for Michigan. First, a little bit of Husky news. Defensive tackle Javon Parker suffered an Achilles rupture during that loss at
Brutal,
Rutgers. He's out
brutal.
for the season. Very disappointing news.
AJ Barner's busy scoring touchdowns in the NFL.
True. True. In Michigan, of all places. We also learned this last week before the Rutgers game. Linebacker Brian Parham announced his plans to redshirt and transfer for a fifth year of eligibility after playing the maximum allowed four games. The San Jose State transfer was pushed down the middle linebacker rotation by the emergence of freshman Kamori House. Emphasized on Twitter, his decision was not related to NIL in the wake of the UNLV controversy that we discussed at the end of last week's pod, simply his desire to maximize his last season of
I think it was
eligibility.
fine. It's unfortunate, and obviously they need the depth, but if you're that experienced and you're not playing, you kind of have to keep playing somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting effect of the redshirt rule being what it is, and I wonder if the college football will look at college NCAA will look at that at all in terms of, players kind of making this decision for themselves.
We're inching closer to endless college. Are we not to like basically it would be a
What
better situation for Byron Parham
is
to
the
probably play out the season for UW and then transfer and have another year. That's kind of, but because of the redshirt rules, he's having to sit for the remainder of the season. But like that's worse for the team and it's worse for the player. There's nobody who really gains for this overall.
Well, whoever
So
gets Brian Parham next year, I suppose, game.
I mean, I guess so. He'll be slightly less wear and tear. They
Oh, I
probably.
see. As opposed to a scenario where you play out the entire season. Yeah, no, I
Yeah,
guess
he
that's
should
not
just
true.
play the year. But again, we are inching closer to basically players can play in college for as long as they want until the time that they are ready to go to the NFL. Like, there has to be some. I think we might end up with like an age cap rather than years or something.
If this doesn't end up with Chris Wankie being able to play quarterback for Florida State, then I want no part of it. So, you know who decided he was ready to go to the NFL?
Who's that?
Jim Harbaugh?
Oh, okay. Heard about him.
Also, JJ McCarthy.
I don't know.
Blake Corum, you may have heard. Michael Penix Jr. All the Huskies receivers. Mikey Senior still? I guess there's probably some Michael Barrett, one-time Seahawk, briefly a Seahawk. Yeah, I mean, it's a weird situation where these teams faced each other again a little bit. It'll be basically a little under 9 months ago, and yet they feel so wildly different given everything that's transpired since. Michigan 4-1 under first-year head coach Sharon Moore, who did co serve as acting coach last season during Harbaugh's suspension. Their lone loss came to Sark and number two Texas, but their first two Big Ten wins came both by identical 27-24 scores, both of them getting close late. USC took a 24-20 lead in the fourth quarter in Ann Arbor before the Wolverines responded with the winning touchdown with 37 seconds left. Last week against Minnesota, they led 24-3 at one point, but the Golden Gophers got within three with 1:40 left before a controversial offside call on the onside kick allowed Michigan to run out the clock. Did you see either of these games?
I didn't. It was kind of frustrating. I kind of wish I would have. But I think I was at Children's Baseball.
I saw a little of Michigan USC while I was at brunch just on a patio. And yeah, it USC
Where were
felt
we
like it.
during Michigan USC?
I can't speak to where you were, but by the
Was
end of the
that the
game, I
day
think we
that
were.
UW?
Yeah, it was
Yeah.
UW Northwestern.
I think I was at Children's Baseball both weeks. We've had games on Saturday. Yeah.
I can't say, like, USC seemed to be moving the ball quite well in that game and the part of it where I watched, but then did eventually lose. And FPI is not impressed. The Michigan is 40th in FPI efficiency, two spots ahead of the Huskies, where you're like the Huskies are a top 20 team. They're 42nd in FPI efficiency. So let's all remain calm here.
How is that possible? I was actually looking at Will Rogers' QBR, and it was worse than Kyle Yakmanis last week. And I'm like, what about, like, what went into the computer?
Well, the reason is he had a fumble. I don't remember what the context was of that fumble. Like, whether it was a drop snap or what.
That's like 30 points of QBR. I mean, like, Kyle Yakmanis was very bad in the game. It was a drop snap. And that is the other thing. I don't know how that's a problem. But... I do not know how that is a problem that UW has, that Will Rogers cannot receive a snap, but there are some things that they need cleaning up. It's more of once the play happens, once Will Rogers has properly received a snap,
as long as there's not a flag,
as long as there's not a flag, everything else is pretty good about what UW does. These are not problems that we could have almost ever anticipated, but he has had a hard time receiving snaps this season, which is kind of a crazy problem to have.
Well, anyways, if you thought Kali Akmanis didn't pass the ball a lot on Friday night, wait till you see Michigan, because the big issue here with them in terms of FBI efficiency is their passing game. Senior Davis Warren started the first three games before junior Alex Orji took over entering conference play. Warren had completed 67% of his passes, but thrown six interceptions through three games. Orji has taken care of the ball with just one pick, but has yet to throw for 100 yards in a game, totaling 118 on 30 attempts the last 2 weeks. Like, it's funny, they got rid of Jim Harbaugh and somehow got more conservative on offense.
I mean, they hired Sherrone Moore. Like, they signed up for more of the same. They weren't, in the same way that UW hiring Jed Fish was kind of signing up for more of the same with Kalen DeBoer. They were like, that worked. Let's do more of that. Michigan won a national championship. They were like, let's do more of that. Will it work? I don't know. Long term, I think Jim Harbaugh is a singular coach that it cannot be replicated with this roster. But it makes sense how everybody got here.
So Moore would rather run the ball. They totaled 591 yards on the ground in back-to-back weeks against Arkansas State, which, yeah, whatever, and then USC. Then we're limited to 155 yards on 43 carries last week by Minnesota. Donovan Edwards was the guy who sort of figured to be the star this year. You may recall that against the Huskies in the national championship game, he came off the bench to run for 104 yards and six carries, including two touchdowns.
I do recall that, in fact.
Yeah. But he has actually been significantly less effective of their two running backs. It's converted linebacker Khalil Mullins, who had three carries for 21 yards in the championship game. I'm not sure the context of those. I think they might have been in garbage time. Has really been, you know, kind of claiming the job is his own. He's averaging 7 yards per carry to 4.4 for Edwards. Has two touchdowns each of the last 3 weeks. At least 111 yards in all of those games. And Edwards had just 9 carries last week. Now, maybe one of the reasons that Mullins did not start off a running back, he is not a threat as a receiver at all. He has one catch for 2 yards.
I mean, yeah,
season.
As a converted linebacker, like.
Their top threat is tight end Colston Loveland, who has 23 catches for 228 yards, halfway to last year's total of 45 catches. No other receiver has even 70 yards this season for Michigan. Loveland was a big part of the national championship game as well. He had three catches for 64 yards. AJ Barner was shut out in that one. Their defense has been good, not great. They're ranked 22nd in FPI efficiency there after being just completely dominant last year. They allowed 4.8 yards per play as compared to 4.3 in the championship run. Have forced two turnovers each of the last 2 weeks, and Minnesota managed just 38 yards on 25 rushes. So it will be interesting to see how they match up with Jonah Coleman from that regard. And then Josiah Stewart leads the team with 4 sacks. Defensive lineman Mason Graham has 3, already matching last season's total.
So I was actually pretty shocked to see. I was filled with anger about this loss to Rutgers on Friday night. And I was shocked when I saw the spreads come out on Sunday for this game that UW was favored in it. Because again, you look at the rankings, UW or Michigan's number 10 in the country right now.
I believe so. Yeah, we have not said that, but yes.
Incredible how they're number 10 and kind of not good statistically, at least.
I mean, it's just funny the disconnect between like whatever it is the polls are trying to capture and what it is the gamblers are trying to capture, which is how good is this team at playing football?
To me, I always break it down for like Vegas knows, right? Vegas is wrong sometimes, but if you look at it enough,
you
overall,
did question the Rutgers 2.5 spread and Rutgers won by 3 points.
I mean,
Obviously,
again,
how we got
Vegas
there
knows.
Was a circuitous mount, but it was funny.
But they're obviously aware of like the FPI efficiency, how Michigan is doing it. This is their first road game of the season. And they also are aware that UW has statistically played pretty well this season. I was really shocked, though, genuinely, to see a top 10 team come into UW having just lost to Wazoo at semi-home and to Rutgers, and to see UW be favored over a top 10 team in the country, right? If you were just talk without any context of that, that is a very surprising situation.
For
but
sure.
the way that UW has played overall and the way that Michigan has played overall, it is the right spread. And I think when you look at it FPI efficiency wise, it's about
Ooh,
what it says.
It has now gone to UW minus 3 at ESPN bet.
So people have bet UW up in this game, which I'm actually, again, I'm impressed because I feel like there's been a lot of negativity around UW. It may just be that there's way more negativity around Michigan than there is UW. And Michigan is such a public team that when they play badly, people notice. If they're winning games but playing badly, UW, people might not have noticed. I mean, it was still pretty late Pacific time, even though they were playing on the East Coast. And I think people were paying more attention to Miami, Virginia Tech on Friday night. But people don't necessarily notice if UW is outplaying how they are. People notice if Michigan is winning, but not actually playing as well. And that, to me, is looking at the Minnesota game. They went up big on Minnesota early, and how Minnesota was able to come back in that game. Because I saw it at first, and I was like, oh, crap. Like, maybe Michigan is actually good. I think they might have actually dropped in the polls. But Max Brosmer, Minnesota's quarterback, and I don't
No, they were number 12 last week.
Okay, so, and now they're number 10?
Yep.
Okay, so the ESPN is capturing that. For all intents and purposes, Minnesota is not a good team. You know, they have a pretty huge loss at home against Iowa. They lost at home against, I think, a pretty bad North Carolina team. And so for them to be on the road in Michigan, coming back the way that they were, dropping 21 points in the fourth quarter, this is a team that you can pass the ball on. And I think it's obviously not, this isn't the Michigan defense that we saw last year that UW faced. And I don't, they're just not as scary of a team defensively at all. So if UW is able to move the ball anywhere near like they did against Rutgers, they have in some of these previous games, it really comes down to, can they load the box and just stop this Michigan run attack enough to make them pass a few times to hold them? It's going to be a little bit more of a grinded out type game. And, you know, the possessions are going to be a little bit longer. It'll be frustrating. But if UW gets up at all in this game, it is going to be fascinating how Michigan responds to that. And it was something that they didn't do at all against Texas. And I think that was kind of the moment where people are like, oh, this is not really a competitive team at this level because of how thoroughly in their house Texas went in and dominated them.
By contrast to the UW-Rutgers game, and UW having the only long drives in that game, both Minnesota and Michigan had 3 drives of double-digit plays on Saturday, and Minnesota also had an 8-play drive.
I think I would be more afraid of Davis Warren, though, to be honest.
It depends how well UW can stop the run game. And Orji is more of a threat on the ground than Davis Warren is. I think that's the other element in the switch here.
They've faced a lot of running quarterbacks so far. I mean, I don't want to say that they handled Mateer, who I think is awesome, by the way. But like, the in the end, outside of losing him a few times, I think John Mateer is a better quarterback than Alex Orji overall.
I think for sure.
But they were able to, for the most part, outside of a couple of plays where they lost him, hold him. He's also a much better passer than Alex Orji is. Steve Belichick's defense is ready for this. And they've kind of proven especially if they get a little Zach Dorfey's back, if he's back and able to play. We'll
Yeah,
see.
Toe is a question mark.
They've seen this already. It's not going to be surprising to them. They played a lot of teams like this overall, and Michigan is worse than Northwestern or better than Northwestern, but I'm not sure if the offensive attack is that different overall. And if UW can just bring everybody forward, say, pass against us, do it, try this. I believe in UW's offense scoring about basically anybody, especially if they're not doing the thing that we talked about in the Rutgers section. If they're scoring touchdowns and not kicking field goals, they're going to move the ball against this team. It is not last year's Michigan. So that doesn't concern me overall. It is how much they can slow Michigan down running the ball, get them to punt a handful of times. And if they don't make mistakes, if Will Rogers can literally receive snaps and not drop them, and if they can finish some of those drives, if Jonah Coleman goes on a long run and it doesn't turn into a field goal attempt, that is going to be huge. It looks pretty nice, I think, overall on Saturday, yes, in a way that Jersey weather wasn't great. I think it's going to be a beautiful night under the lights on Montlake. It's going to be a great atmosphere, and UW, just everything is kind of pointed to this game from last year. Everything is different, but there's a revenge factor. A lot of these players on the UW team were there last year, and they still want to beat Michigan. This is a welcome to the Big Ten type of game. This would be a statement for UW to win this. And Jed Fish knows, this team knows, they're just a better team also. Vegas knows. So I'm excited for it, and I'm feeling confident going into it. As I have all of these games, and UW has consistently, 5 weeks in a row, outplayed their opponent.
I don't know that they outplayed Washington State.
5 weeks in a row.
You know, the game that I think back on as we talk about this, and I think the thing you're underestimating is like the degree to which Michigan just has better skill position talent than Northwestern, even if their quarterback play isn't necessarily better. Or, I mean, it probably is better, but it's not that much better. And, you know, can UW just make the tackles? Or is it, you know, the long runs that we did see from Rutgers on Friday night, as much as you want to kind of dismiss them?
I mean, how many of them were there? Two? Two long runs?
No, there was more than that. There were plays, drives where they didn't score, where they had long runs. Like the one four and out that they had, there was a 40-yard run on the first play. So you're too dismissive.
Did they fall?
They had a first down run, and then they had three plays and punted. Boom, boom, boom. So it's a four and out.
Okay, got it.
The last time that Michigan visited the shores of Montlake, Husky Stadium, because their trip was scheduled for the canceled 2020 season.
Yep.
And we merely saw the return of that game in 2021. It was postponed, but then once it became clear UW was headed to the Big Ten, that game, or once it was a possibility that UW was headed to the Big Ten, that game got canceled. Anyway, it was back in 2001. Another time coming off a year where the Huskies won the Pac-12. At that point, the Pac-10. The total for this game in Vegas is 41.5 points. If you look at the, you know, that and combine it with the line, it's implying a score somewhere around the same score that we had last time, which was a 23-18 UW win, spurred by a Rock Alexander blocked kick return for a touchdown, I want to say. Yeah. So that's the kind of
lose one at Michigan too in a similar situation.
2002, they had the 12 men on the field during a missed field goal that Michigan subsequently.
Can you imagine how that's fucking undisciplined? That is way more undisciplined than a phantom face mask.
I think the Huskies have managed some things like that, like the way they managed the clock at the end of that game. You left out that discussion. I wasn't like paying close attention, but not scoring before the 2 minute timeout.
I think people were a little bit too down on that. Again, it's easier said than done.
I mean, I don't like think any of these individual things are that like indicators of the coaching staff not being buttoned up, but the fact that all of these things, different things keep happening is a little concerning to me.
But who's the quarterback of that team, by the way?
In 2001?
Henson.
No. Which game are you looking at?
2001 Michigan Wolverines football roster, Drew Henson.
Well, he didn't play against UW. John Navarre played in the game.
Oh, okay.
I went and looked at the box score. He played in both games against UW, as a matter of fact. So I wasn't surprised that these games were close in terms of the spread. I thought it would be more like a pick 'em. I didn't expect UW to be favored to this degree, but I don't think it's necessarily wrong. Chances of victory?
65%.
That's very optimistic. I'm going 55%.
Have I seemed unoptimistic about this UWT all
I'm not
season?
at any point. No. No,
I
sir.
have my conviction about this UW team has been so strong for this entire heading into the season and since they have started playing, and it is unfazed by Michigan. I mean, you talk about the difference between them and Northwestern. Alex Orji has not done anything to show that he is a better passer than what's the dude's name? Jack Loesch?
What did Jack Loesch go 6 of 17?
I mean, it hasn't happened yet. Like, have they played a defense? Has Alex Orji played a defense like UW's defense yet?
Are we that convinced that UW's defense is that much better than USC?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I don't know what USC's defense looks like this week, this season. But again, the UW defense does not rate statistically like you think it rates. We've talked
I
about this
still.
before. Yeah, USC is 14th in FPI defensive efficiency. UW is
Really?
39th.
How did they lose that game? I mean, I guess they just got run all over, but like high passing, 32 yards. I mean, I guess it basically comes down to can they slow down Kalel Mullins?
Yeah,
And
it does.
we will see. He had a 63-yard rush there. He averaged almost 10 yards per carry. If that happens again, they're going to lose.
The Huskies won that game in 2001 without a single offensive touchdown. I remember the Rock
I thought there was a
Alexander.
safety early, right?
Was there a safety? I don't
They
think
also
so.
did a pretty good job, but I mean, Alex Orji in that game had a 28 QBR. It was Kalel Mullings won the game for Michigan, and there's a reality that Vegas just doesn't see that happening again.
Omari
So,
Lowe also had a pick six in that
oh,
game. I did
Omari
not remember
Lowe.
that. Let's remember some guys.
But last week against Minnesota, now that maybe the book's a little bit more out on him, 4.6 yards per carry. And if they're anywhere near that, where does Minnesota rank FPI defense?
Twenty-sixth.
Really? Okay.
I don't know if you're
So
aware of this.
bet.
All these Big Ten teams are much better at defense than offense.
Yes.
A lot of good defenses in the Big Ten, not that many great offenses.
I mean, I look forward to seeing it, and if it's truly Michigan's line is that much better than UW's defensive line and front seven, we will see that play out. But I think throughout a game, it is not an easy way to win a game, having to do that over and over and over again. If there's a hold, something like that, that backs you up in a huge way. And
Well,
again, this being their first road game, it is
UW's
just
opponents are never the ones who have the holds. It's just UW.
it's a diff but Rutgers
You
punted
say
a
this.
lot.
They did, yes.
It's not like Rutgers didn't punt. If you give me the Kyle Manungai game from Kalel Mullings, that's a UW win.
I probably, yes.
So
I
I'm
do. I
comfortable
think
with
that
that.
Kalel Mullins and the Michigan offensive line are better than Manungai and the Rutgers offensive line.
Plus being on the road. I mean, again, Vegas doesn't think so, and I think that matters.
I mean, it does to a degree.
But also, they needed, for Rutgers to have won that game, they needed UW to make a lot of mistakes. Like, it wasn't one. They needed UW to miss three field goals,
Rutgers
to
defense
not
is
score.
not as good as the Michigan defense.
But they
This
needed
is
them
what
to.
you're forgetting.
I will be very, very curious to see how Jonah Coleman plays against them and
I
how
will
they play.
too.
They're going to try to stop Jonah Coleman, and I think Will Rogers could go off in this game.
I mean, that's been the whole season.
I would love for it to be. I would love for them to stack the box against Jonah Coleman. It hasn't been the whole season because both Jonah Coleman and Will Rogers went off against Rutgers.
Fair.
They both had amazing games. But I would love to see Michigan be like, we're going to stop Jonah Coleman. That is our number one goal. And Will Rogers to go nuts against them. And that's what might happen in this one. I don't know. This team is better than I've watched every down basically. They are a better team than this. They are a better team than they've played on the field. And the penalties are obviously hurting them. There are some things to clean up, but they're going to beat Michigan on Saturday.
62% of the time.
Five.
Seattle Seahawks on Sunday return home to face the New York Football Giants. Not their official name. The Giants lost their opener 28-6 to Minnesota. Competitive 21-1-2 since then. They lost 21-18 at the Commanders, which seems like a really impressive defensive performance in the wake of the last 2 weeks for Washington. 121-15 in Cleveland, and then lost 20-15 to Dallas on Thursday.
They also lost
football.
That 21-18 without a kicker. They probably would have won had they had a kicker.
Oh, that was the game where Graham Gano got injured? I don't remember the context of this at all.
Yeah. The Giants actually not as bad as I thought they were overall.
24th in DVOA, 23rd in offense, 21st in defense, 30th in special teams. Perhaps in part because they had a punter attempting kicks at one point.
Oh, no, they had no one.
No, the punter missed an extra point.
Oh, did he? And then they started just going for it.
Daniel Jones, coming back off the ACL tear that ended his season, has improved his yards per attempt each week. Week one was awful. He went 22 of 42 for 186 yards with two touchdowns and five sacks against Brian Flores and the Vikings. Not an easy landing spot, but threw for a season high 281 yards last week against the Cowboys, albeit in 40 attempts. And look, there's one reason that Daniel Jones has played better lately. Well, there's two reasons. He has gotten healthier. But the reason is Malik Nabers, the number six pick, after a modest debut with five catches for 66 yards, has subsequently averaged 10 catches for 107 yards with three touchdowns in that span.
Kind of incredible. Pre-draft, I was like, I think Rome Odunze might be better than Malik Nabers. We'll see long-term. I think Malik Nabers is better than Rome Odunze. Just LSU. Just draft LSU players.
Receivers in particular. Rome Odunze, terrific player. Going to have a fine career. He's got his work cut out for him to catch Malik Nabers.
Yes.
Because Malik Nabers is catching everything. His 35 total catches through four games, second to Puka Nacua in NFL history. He's catching 67% of his targets for 7.4 yards each. The rest of the team is averaging 5.9 yards per target, including 5.1 for slot receiver Wandale Robinson, the only other player on the roster with more than 15 targets. Now, Nabers did leave Thursday Night Football with a concussion, but was back in the building Monday. We'll see what his status is for this week.
How does that usually work? I mean, is there a certain amount of time that you need post-concussion?
It just depends on your symptoms and how you progress through the protocol. So, you know, having 10 days is better than having 7 days, but it's not a guarantee. Giants are number 28 in rushing EPA. It is tempting to attribute that to the loss of Saquon Barkley, but they were 31st a year ago, granting that nobody was really respecting the Giants' passing attack. Devin Singletary coming over from the Bills has been meh. And Devin Singletary, he was with the Bills last year. And rookie Tyrone Tracy has just 29 yards on 12 carries. I had some high hopes for him on at least one of my fantasy teams. Giants offensive line actually pretty elite by ESPN metrics. They're number six in pass block win rate, number four in run block win rate. They addressed that this offseason, added John Runyon notably. So it seems to be an issue of either a combination of the situations in which they're running and then the running backs as opposed to the offensive line in this specific case. Giants defense perfectly middling. They're 20th in dropback EPA, 19th in rush EPA, basically average in both pass rush and run stop win rate. They are third in sack rate after finishing 30th a year ago. And the funny thing, this has had almost nothing to do with Brian Burns, who they added via trade. He has just one sack through four games, but Dexter Lawrence has three, and so does safety Jason Pinnick. So watch out for him on the safety blitz.
Interesting.
Giants just one interception thus far.
I feel like Dexter Lawrence has always kind of been like a Seahawk killer.
That sounds about right.
There was that game that we lost just brutally. How many years ago was that? On like December Sunday?
Oh, that could be so many times.
It was one of those like Pete Carroll losses where you're just like, how are we losing to this team? But I remember the Big Cat was a big part of that also.
I would say, was that the 2021 season?
That sounds right.
Because there was a year where they lost to both the Giants and the Jets. Am I remembering that right?
That also sounds right. I remember Leonard Williams being a part
No, it
of.
was 2020. So it was the end of the Let Russ Cook
Oh,
era.
interesting. Yeah.
17-12 win in Seattle in
Ugh.
week 13.
I just distinctly remember that loss being very frustrating. This is a very different Giants team in some ways. I mean, the Malik Nabers thing changes things for them offensively. I'm kind of fascinated to see the Seahawks secondary, which did not look very good today against the Lions. And, you know, like Amon-Ra St. Brown was wide open. Jameson Williams was wide open. Tim Patrick was wide open. Whether the Giants are capable of scheming them that open, I am a little bit more skeptical of vis-a-vis the Lions and just the amount of skill players. But like the ball is going to get to Blake Neighbors quite a bit. So it'll be interesting to see how the Seahawks handle that. Rick Woolen really didn't do much. Like just nobody from the secondary stood out.
Yeah.
The thing that's going to matter the most is who's back in the building and who from the defensive line, Julian Love, who is playing.
Julian Love revenge game.
Yeah. It's a revenge game, also, Leonard Williams.
Geno
But,
Smith, a lot of revenge
and
games.
yeah, it's almost like players play for multiple teams throughout their career. But I think that's going to matter quite a bit for this game is who's back. And it doesn't seem like almost any of them are looking at long-term injuries. There should be a handful of these players back for this Giants
It
game.
didn't sound
And I
like
think that
Mafe was
changes
going to be
things.
able to get back,
Okay.
but
I mean, that's a huge one if
maybe
he's
the
not.
interior lineman. Chenna Nwosu also a possibility this week. We haven't really talked about him. He is one of these guys who has been sidelined because he has been out all season.
And they've withstood for the first handful of weeks,
Well,
Uchenna's.
they withstood it when they had Boye Mafe.
Yes. So having one of them, it's going to be a big factor in this game. There's also just the other piece that the Seahawks are probably just a better team than the Giants. Offensively, they should be able to move the ball against the Giants, this team. And the offense for the Giants isn't explosive enough, probably, to do to them today what the Lions did. So it's a nice
I will
game.
confidently say they are not explosive enough to average 7.8 yards per play. I'm going to take the under on that for the Giants.
Just coming back with a 70-yard touchdown right after you score. So frustrating.
Ooh. Yeah.
It's probably not happening in this one. I mean, it took the Lions ended up winning comfortably, but it took a phenomenal performance for the Lions to win at home against the Seahawks team. And the Lions also probably have a better defense than the Giants do as well. So if Geno cooks the way that we think he can and the offense has the game, I think similar to weeks one through three, they can win this comfortably unless a bunch of shit happens and they don't. And that's kind of what happened weeks one through three was a handful of mistakes, not being able to finish series, just weird herky jerky stuff, penalties, and they didn't. Today wasn't as afflicted with that. This was a little bit more. This was the smoothest the offense looked all season. And if it looks anything like that, I think they could beat the Giants comfortably.
Dexter Lawrence has never recorded a sack against the Seahawks, so I don't know that I would say that he has been
Oh, interesting.
a thorn in their side. The third consecutive year these teams have played last year really does not, the 24-3 Seahawks win does not really tell us much of anything.
Was that the Monday Night Football game, though, where Spoon had the pick six?
Yes, it was.
Okay, that was a big game. That was kind of like the coming out party for
So Daniel
Spoon.
Jones was still healthy at that point, for the record.
Yes.
The
I believe he
2022
got
game.
hurt in that game.
I don't know if it was in that game, but the 2022 game seems a bit more representative. That was a Giants team that won a playoff game, and yet the
That
Seahawks,
information just doesn't sound, that doesn't sit right with me.
they came in 6-1, and the Seahawks handed them their second loss by a 27-13 final.
And I
Since that
know.
2020 loss, which came against the great Colt McCoy,
Oh, yes. I
they
know that
have
that game
won the
happened.
two
Well, I guess if
consecutive
Colt McCoy was
matches.
starting, we were like, this team is 6-1, but they're not actually this good
No,
statistically.
Colt
They
McCoy
can't.
started the 2020 game where they
Okay.
won. Daniel Jones started the last 2 years, both Seahawks wins.
I guarantee you, we talked about it and we were just like, this team isn't actually as good as their record indicates. And then the Seahawks just comfortably won.
Chances of victory?
what is the spread is 6.5. I don't know. It's probably like a 75% chance.
I mean, the FBI has it much lower than that, but I'm going 70%.
Just a cool 20 for 53 for Saquon in that game.
No one ever remembers those games.
3 receptions for 9 yards for the running back that's more like a wide receiver. Devastated to lose.
Fly ball caught.
This will be it's a nice game to have before they play the Niners, and hopefully this is a get right game for the team overall. I think Mike McDonald is not going to be pleased with the team, the defense in particular this week, and I think they're going to kind of get straight against the Giants.
One would hope.
So it's a nice opportunity to do so. It'd be fun to see Malik Nabers, though. Malik Nabers matched up against Boone and Reek. I think it'll be fun to see him. I'm curious to see how much that continues. And two of the top receiving yards leaders in the NFL between him and DK Metcalf in this one.
Yeah. Hope he's able to be healthy and be out there. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.
It was my first Mateo's football game that I got to go to this year because
Seahawks weren't playing. You were in Vegas.
We were in Vegas, and then the Seahawks were at home, which annoyingly, the Seahawks are at home constantly. This game today was the first game I got to, Seahawks game I got to watch on TV, which, like, I like being at Seahawks games, but I also really like watching Seahawks games on TV. Because you just know what's going on so much more and who's doing things and stuff like that. Like when you're at the game, the individual players, like even the Huskies, it's really hard to tell sometimes like who is doing what at various times. And this was the first Husky game that I watched on TV too, right?
I don't know if I agree with this assessment.
Like individual defensive linemen and stuff, it is way easier if they're like, that was so-and-so making a play.
Yeah, I suppose that part of it. But it's not anyway, like, who is this guy running for long touchdowns? Is it Jonah Coleman? Is it another running back? Who can say?
Okay, you understand the difference. I said individual defensive players.
But you clarified that after.
I'm very aware of who Jonah Coleman is. But I'm the most aware of who Jonah Coleman is, probably of anybody in the country, except for Las Vegas.
You've already made these references in the podcast.
So, we show up to the game. Mateo is like quite sick, actually. He didn't go to school the next day, but of course he was there for football because there's so many situations. Like last week, Kayleen was like, we were going to the batting cages and Luca had some sort of like long project due. And she was like, should I just do it for him? And I was like, yes, because baseball is more important than school.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The priorities are with children's sports.
There's a reason it's coaches' quarter and not parent quarter around here.
But
also copyright infringement, but that's one reason too.
If you think you could copyright a segment on a podcast. So anyway, we show up. Mateo's like quite sick. He's freaking out during practice because you practice for an hour because he doesn't want to play quarterback. He wants to be the center more often and play receiver constantly. And I'm just like, Mateo, I had like pulled him aside and I was like, dude, I was like, first off, everybody has skill sets. You're not that good at catching the ball. And I was like, other players on the team are going to get past the ball more and you're going to get very angry if you're playing receiver. You're able to throw the ball and make the right decision about things. Also, it's the most important fucking position. I was like the only child on the face of the earth who's like, I don't want to play quarterback. But then
Mateo reacted to the 3-week downturn in offense in the NFL and was like, I got to get out of quarterback. No one can play it anymore.
I showed him the golf game and he's back. he was like, you can catch touchdowns and throw touchdowns at quarterback.
Wow. So
you're
true.
You're not restricted. But the
it was alive for
the Philly special.
I mean, yeah. He knows, he of all people knows the Philly special. Yes,
highly aware. So the referee for the game, we hadn't had him since the championship game last year.
Oh, wow.
Ed Hockley. I don't know his name. Literally, I just call him Ed.
You go up to him and like, good game, Ed.
Well, the last game was like, that was the Super Bowl of the previous season, so it's a little bit more tense. And he also called the like the crossing the line of scrimmage on the first touchdown of the game, so we were a little frustrated with him. But this game, he was way more friendly. But being on the sidelines with him, like, we're complaining about things or whatever, and he was like, just so you know, here's why this thing is this thing. And then breaks down all of the rules for his calls and stuff.
Right.
It's incredible, because the two options for referees in these children play games are the most serious referee I have ever seen in my entire life outside of professional referees, or some 15-year-old who doesn't give a fuck. And I'm like, I love that it's like the two extreme versions of things. One who a person who like tentatively knows the rules, and another person who's like, just so you know, here's the rule for this type of play.
Right.
So there was a play where a player's shirt was untucked, and they grabbed the shirt instead of the flag. And I'm like, he didn't get, and the referee, Ed blew the play dead. And I was like, they didn't pull his flag. What the hell? And I'm not saying this to him. I'm just orating this, you know, like you would when you're watching a football game.
Right.
And he was like, just so you know, in this situation, the play is, because his shirt was untucked, the second they grab for a flag, the play is then blown dead immediately in that situation. And I'm like, well, all right. I'm like, you got me there, Ed. And he was like, that is technically a penalty, but at this age, I don't call those. And I'm like, okay. It was the most immaculately refereed. My favorite was that we got many warnings about spiking the ball after touchdowns, which of course we're spiking the ball like crazy, celebrating. And he came down, and eventually we got an unsportsmanlike conduct call for a touchdown. Mateo threw two touchdowns, by the way. He played quarterback the entire, so they had like a defensive unit for the first half who switched to the offensive unit for the second half, and vice versa. Threw two tutties, hitting wide open receivers. Like, we throw the ball way more than any other flag football team. We really were like fucking, we were like Mike Leach out there offense this last week. It was a lot of passing. Working the short game, mixing in the long game a little bit. But so the kid spikes the ball, and then he does these like to the crowd is my favorite thing about it. Personal foul, unsportsmanlike conduct on the touchdown. He was like, the touchdown counts. And it's like, he explains everything. He was like, the penalty will be enforced on the 2-point conversion. Are you going for one or two or whatever? It was really just like, it's so much fun having him work these games. And we ended up winning because of some pretty monster plays. Like, there was a big fourth down conversion. And my other favorite part about it is that the children don't know the situation at all. And the four coaches are so hyper aware of what the situation is. Like, Luca on the sideline, who's not one of the coaches, I mind you, we were up with the ball, and he was like, we need to run the ball to run clock. And I was like, dog, it's a running clock. I was like, they're not stopping the clock on incompletions. We don't have to do anything. But there was like a long fourth down that we needed to pick up, and we ended up picking it up. And us on the side, it was game over when we picked it up, basically. There was like 1 minute left, so they weren't going to touch the ball. And we're like celebrating, high-fiving on the sidelines, knowing that it's game over. And the children have no idea. There was also a game-saving touchdown. The other team had one play at the end of the first half, and we made a tackle at like literally the last defender pulled the flag or whatever, and we're just like freaking out. Huge fucking play. And Caden just like, I just pulled a flag. He has no idea the magnitude of this stuff. Anyway, 3 seconds left.
I kind of prefer
left.
It that way.
No, I mean, it really is like we are aware. We're doing all the thinking, the strategic thinking for the children. They're just executing whatever we tell them. But there was 3 seconds left in the game. There's no, like, if you fumble, the play is over. If you throw a pick, the play is over. It's just the other team's ball. There's no way offensively for the defense to score. And so the clock was winding down, and Ed was there with like 5 seconds left. And he was like, five. And I was like, timeout. Cause we had the ball at like the 15 or whatever. And I was like, we have to just like straight up Madden style run a play here. And so I called a timeout, and the coach who was on the field was kind of just like, what are you doing? And I was like, literally, we stand to lose nothing. As long as this play takes 3 seconds, the game is over, and we get to give a kid who had like hadn't touched the ball that much another play. And right. I'm like, let's just go for it. So I was very stoked. They're undefeated now. They're 3-0.
Nice.
It was, and then Mateo cried the entire way home about how he only wants to play defense. I'm like, eventually today he finally has accepted that I'm playing quarterback, but I'm just like, what is wrong with you?
Do you think the Eagles fandom is to blame somehow?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they have Jalen Hurts. Like, that is a quarterback like to look up to.
You would think.
It was much better than watching the Seahawks game with Mateo today, though, when somewhere in the fourth quarter, I'm like, locked in, and he's rambling about politics or whatever, and
Wait,
I'm
what?
literally, I'm like, could you please be here in the football game with me and not over in wherever you're at right now? And he was like, I'm on my high horse, Dad.
Oh man, that
Being
apple is
on
not
his high
falling
horse, he was
too
literally just
far
like
from the tree.
ranting about people who didn't like Kamala or something. I'm just like, Mateo, like, yes, fine, but can you be right here? And then Kayleen after was like, where do you think he learned the term on my high horse? And where do you think he learned to be on his high horse from? And especially about politics. Being
Learned watching you,
I
Dad.
learned this from you, Dad.